So now I'm going to endow you as a superhero, and I'm going to say, I need to be rescued, and allowing people to step into, again, a space that is developmental. And, you know, we are so used to thinking that development is something that we do with our young people. But development is a lifelong journey, and even people in advanced stages of dementia are entitled and deserving of a space that is developmental, that looks at them and says, you are more than the life experience you have had. There is more to come for you, and I want to be part of what's more to come. So let's make something new together right now.
Welcome to the Dementia Research Project. I'm Matt Duray, and in this podcast, I explore the history, innovation, and champions in and around the world of dementia.
Nicola Pauling is a trainer and facilitator with over 20 years' experience developing people and communities through play and performance. She's the founder of Voice Arts, an award-winning organization that provides access to drama-based creative programs in New Zealand. An actor and performer herself, she has led many successful projects in partnerships with government agencies, local councils, health professionals, and social service providers.
Great. Thanks so much for your time. First things first, I mean, I came across Voice Arts New Zealand and I thought you guys are doing really important work. As somebody from the media space, I can resonate with a lot of the mission. If you don't mind sharing, what is Voice Arts New Zealand all about?
Yeah, well, thank you. So we are what you would describe as a creative space, and that we support human development, learning and growth through a creative practice. And for Voice Arts, that creative practice is theatre-based, so using drama and improvisation. And a lot of people hear that and they just go, oh no, that's not for me. I don't do that kind of thing. And what we try to do is to gently support people to recognize that we all have this innate ability to performatively play, and that when we allow ourselves to step into that playful space, there's a huge scope for very transformative, efficient learning and growth that happens. We're not training people to be actors and to be on stage or to be in front of audiences. We are supporting people to be better versions of themselves and supporting people to do that in relationship with others. So performance, while you can get solo examples of performing, most theatrical creative work is a team experience. And so you discovering yourself and learning about yourself and developing in relationship to other people. So you're in a room with other people while this is happening. Yeah. And so we're taking all of the tools and the training that actors use and improvisers use. Yeah.
And who are the target audience for Voice New Zealand?
So at the moment, the target audience for most of the work we do at Voice Arts is for people in a third age. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that term, but it generally means, yeah, people in there, the idea that you have a first age and you have a middle age and you have a third age, and your third age, you know, likely being over the age of 65 through till whenever. So we work with people in their 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. That's mostly where we work. We also do work with former refugees and new migrants in the language learning space. So we do work there. And then I personally do quite a lot of work in the corporate business space, where I'm supporting emerging and executive leaders to be more aware of their performance choices. So it kind of spans quite a range.
Right. So that's a very diverse audience, right? Could you speak to how you would adapt your training for the different audiences? Because I am sure there's some level of personalization involved.
Yes. And no, people are often interested in and curious to know about how we adapt. So, for example, if we're doing work with people in their third age, but then we're specifically working with a group of people who are living with a diagnosis of dementia, then people are curious to know, well, how do you do it differently? You know, how do you adapt the tools that you use in that space to work with this group of people who have this diagnosis? And in all honesty, Matthew, there's not a lot of change. The tools, incredibly useful and effective in a real range of participant groups. And I would say that the change happens in the facilitation style and the way that an activity might be facilitated, the pace with which we might work. Yeah. But a lot of the tools are incredibly useful in all sorts of different spaces. And that's something that I really love about the work. It just works everywhere.
And I think one of the really unique aspects about Voice Arts New Zealand is you don't have a physical space. So you meet people where they are or in a common facility, right?
We do.
And how does that affect how you pick people with dementia as an example, right? How does meeting them where they are physically make a difference to your programming?
Yeah, great question. It's always been part of the philosophy for Voice Arts to go to where people are rather than asking people to come to us. And we have found that there is more ease and more trust in the work if we are able to bring our work into a space that is already familiar to a group of people, where even perhaps they have a sense of ownership over, like they feel that they belong there and that perhaps we are the guests coming into their space. That's a setup that we prefer working with than bringing people into what might be our space, and which we don't have because we've never worked that way. And we, because of the nature of the way that we work, we are resource light. We are often coming into a workshop with a group of people with nothing but ourselves and the ideas that we have in our head. But we don't need to bring kit or gear or not big boxes of things. So perhaps like a creative space that is based in visual arts, it makes sense for them to have a location because there is a lot of equipment required for people to do visual art. But in the way that we work, nothing is required other than the people and the room. And we work in lots of different spaces. You know, we try to move tables and chairs out of the way where we can so that we have a space to move because the work is embodied. But other than that, you know, we don't require anything, not even a script, because so much of the work that we do is spontaneous or improvisational. So rather than coming into a group with a Shakespeare script and handing out roles and saying you're going to play this character and everybody turn to page 10 and we will read, we come into the room and we create pieces of performance using whatever's in the room, whatever's in the mind of the people that we're working with. So it's easy for us to come to people.
Right. I think, at least from my understanding of people with dementia, that's the correct way to do it. Have you noticed differences when you conduct this type of training one-on-one versus like in group settings? Or is it typically in group settings is how you do it?
We do most of our work with group settings. I do personal coaching, but most of the work is done in groups. Sometimes not huge groups. We like to keep our numbers quite small, particularly working with people with dementia, you know, around that 8 to 12 is a really lovely number to have in the room. Yeah, and it's an opportunity for people to experience participation and then in the next beat to experience observation in terms of suddenly being an audience member. So in one beat, participant might be engaging in an activity or a scene, and then they might get the opportunity just to sit and watch something else happen. And there's a lot of benefit to being in both of those roles. And so that's what group work is so great for. So you get to participate, but you get to observe, watch other people step out of themselves and into something else. Yeah, just yesterday I had a woman come into a group that I was running and she said, I just want to watch. Mm. And I said, that's fine. And she just spent the whole 90 minutes sitting in a chair with this grin on her face. And she was just completely absorbed in everything that was happening. And at the end, she just said it was just extraordinary for her to watch these people become different versions of themselves. And it was just such a delight for her.
I think I would fall into that category as well, as an observer, also partly because maybe there's a fear of judgment. And how do you, especially with persons with dementia, right, when there's that level of vulnerability, how do you get them from observers to participators? Like, what's that magic that's involved?
Oh, there's a couple of different ways. I mean, I like to, we try to set up a space with a clear intention. So before the participants even come into the room, there has been some care taken to try and establish for them that they are about to embark on something that is participatory. So we try to set that up to begin with. And I would say 98% of the time, people will willingly participate. And that is because the way that we would begin a workshop is often with activities that are effortless to participate in. And we would set up the space so that people are sitting in a circle and then it just begins. The facilitator says, right, and we're doing this. And we choose activities that support people to participate at the same time. So everybody is doing the same thing at the same time. Nobody is being called upon. Nobody is being singled out. Nobody is being asked to stand up. But everyone is being asked to participate. So there is that expectation forming in the room. And this is the lovely dynamic of being in a social environment. As human beings, we seek to belong and we seek to fit in. And so if you can see something is happening in the room and it feels achievable and effortless, then you will participate. Mostly, there's the rare occasion where we might encounter someone who really does not want to, and that is just fine.
How do you see, like, the impact of time in these sessions? Because I imagine like people get more comfortable with the group, with the activity itself.
Yeah. Yeah. We witness people becoming braver and more willing to experiment and experience and almost a yearning for it. Once they experience it, they want more. And so coming back every week, What are we doing? Can we do this? And asking for particular activities. We also see the relationships within the group develop over time. And the social connection is one of the three main aims or outcomes that we're seeking in the work that we do, particularly with people living with a diagnosis of dementia. So the three things we talk about is cognitive stimulation, social connection, and creativity. And the social, watching the relationships develop over over time with a group who are meeting every week is one of the joys to watch. Someone once described it to me as an experience of fast tracking intimacy, and I don't mean intimacy in any way that's inappropriate, but an intimacy that moves us beyond a tolerance for another human being, or just like, yeah, nice, but moves us into a space where we feel a family-like connection to the other people in the room. They become important to us, and our care of them and their care of us becomes important. So, yeah, we witnessed that, and it's really lovely to watch that those relationships develop.
Speaking of time, right? I mean, zooming out, this for things like dementia, I mean, the sad fact is it's a degenerative disease. So what are some of the challenges you see, like, with people who come to this, like, over time, when maybe their capabilities also are not as what they once were?
Yes, we absolutely witness that. And that is unavoidable when you work in this space. But we set up a practice where we work with people who have are in the early stages of dementia, and then we have programs working with people who are quite advanced. Mm. And different programs, and just taking a slightly different approach to how we are in the room. You talked about participation, and one of the lovely ways that we work, particularly with people who are more in the more advanced stages of dementia, is by using this wonderful improvisational term called endowment. And if so, we might be a team of practitioners going into a group to work with a group, or just one. But because we are theatre practitioners, so we're all actors and improvisers ourselves, we will simply move towards somebody and endow them. Matthew, I would like 2 scoops of vanilla ice cream, please. And if you could put some sprinkles on it, that would be delightful. You know, and straight away you're like, oh, I'm the ice cream. Okay. And you come alive with it. It's really beautiful to watch. So with the change in some of the cognitive ability, we shift the emphasis of the program away from the cognitive stimulation. That cognitive stimulation is really important for people in the early stages. They really want an experience of stretching the brain, of really feeling like they're working. For people who are more advanced, that experience can become too distressing. But what they still want and still benefit from and is still stimulating is the creativity, enabling them to step into performative play with another human being. And so much of the work that happens with people who are living with dementia, and what I have seen, is an idea that we spend a lot of time reminiscing. And I know that there is importance in reminiscence theory and using music, but for me and for voice arts and the work that we do, I am more interested in what is still to come. You know, what is new? Mm. What can we still play with? That's not about simply walking you down memory lane, but is building something new that you've never done before. You know, that you've never experienced before. So now I'm going to endow you as a superhero, and I'm going to say, I need to be rescued, and allowing people to step into, again, the space that is developmental. And, you know, we are so used to thinking that development is something that we do with our young people. Young people need development. But development is a lifelong journey, and even people in advanced stages of dementia are entitled and deserving of a space that is developmental, that looks at them and says, you are more than the life experience you have had. there is more to come for you, and I want to be part of what's more to come. So let's make something new together right now.
You know, that example you did earlier with the calling me out for the coffee, that was such so powerful, right? And it really, I guess, brought to life the practicality of the exercise rather than a conversation. Like, it took me to a different space. And it suddenly became very real, right? Even for me.
Yeah. And I think that's the skill that we bring as theatre practitioners. We are not medical professionals. We are not doctors or nurses, but we have trained in this ability to be relationally creative. You know, we can step towards somebody and make something happen with them. And that is our gift. It's like that's our superpower. And we know that everyone, no matter where they are in their stage of life, has this capacity to respond playfully and performatively.
How do you go about sharing this gift, Nicola? Like, to, I imagine, like in care facilities, even in medical spaces, mm-hmm. right? It is a gift. How do you think about sharing your skill set?
Yeah.
To a wider audience.
Yeah. We provide training for staff who are working in care facilities. We provide workshops for caregivers who are the primary caregivers for somebody who is still in a home environment, and just and supporting all of those people to have some tools that give them another way to be in relationship with somebody who is on a journey with dementia. And it's one of the ways that we do it. Talking to someone like you, Matthew, when we get emails from people who are like, come and tell us about what you do. Yeah, where possible, we speak at conferences and places like that, just trying to spread the word about the tool that we use and how wonderful it is. I don't know, Matthew, if you know much about improv or improvisational theatre. Do you? Is there much of that happening in your world?
I know about Yes And. It's pretty limited.
So we use a lot of improv training activities that we use in the work that we do for people living with dementia, which people might hear that and go, you do what? You do improv with people who are living with dementia? Yes, we do. For those of you that are, you know, have possibly heard of something like Whose Line Is It Anyway, which is a Canadian, American, British TV program, and or might have seen improvisational theatre. Professional improvisers, and I'm a professional improviser myself, we walk out onto a stage in front of an audience, and we have no idea what is about to happen. From moment to moment, it's going to be made up on the spot, but we're doing that in front of people. And the way that we know that we're going to be okay in that space and know that we are going to create stories and performances that an audience is going to enjoy is because we have trained heavily in all of the tools and the philosophy of improvisational theatre. And you mentioned one of them, which is this capacity of yes and, where you accept and build and work with whatever is given to you. No offer is wrong. There's no way to be wrong when you're doing improvisational theatre. And for people who are living with dementia and who experience themselves in the world as getting things wrong and forgetting things and people saying to them, no, that's not, no, it wasn't like that. You went there yesterday. No, that's not right. For them to have an experience of being in relationship with somebody that no matter what they say, how they say it, the person in front of them is going to yes and is going to not only yes, and they're going to build with that, and they're just going to go wherever you want to take them. The two of you are going to go on a journey where whatever you say or do is the right thing. And that's such a beautiful space. There's so much dignity in that space. And you will know, Matthew, that in a lot of the care spaces and a lot of the experience of people living with dementia, dignity is stripped from them in ways that I hope one day we will all be ashamed of, because it's not how we should be taking care of and looking after people who are on this journey. So the relationships that we can create give so much agency and so much dignity and so much freedom and safety, because, if I say to you, I saw my mother yesterday, and we all know that mum died whenever, it's like, oh, beautiful. How was she? What did you do? Lovely. You know, it's just, yeah.
Right. When you were talking just now, the word neuroplasticity popped into my brain a couple of times.
Right?
And do you work with academia or any branches of universities to, I guess, make this practice a formal requirement in care settings?
We haven't had that offer yet. We do work very closely with dementia service providers here in New Zealand, and we have done partner studies with them on our programs. And and all of the data is incredibly positive for the outcomes that we are seeking. But no, at this stage, you know, we've talked about it. Last year, we were in quite close conversation with a professor at Massey University about doing exactly this, but it's incredibly hard and incredibly expensive to do this kind of research in a way that, yeah, that meets all the peer assessment requirements in academia. We got very close to it, but it just didn't, unfortunately, follow through. Yeah. So at the moment, people just have to trust us, or they have to come into the room and watch it.
Having spoken to a lot of different people doing a lot of different things, right? Innovative, creative, in care settings, I can say there's a lot of energy and momentum trending in the right direction, right? Especially when people talk about non-pharmacological interventions, natural therapies. So hopefully we get there. That day is sooner rather than later.
I hope so. But yes, I mean, it is, big part of the focus of our work is around cognitive stimulation, knowing that, how important it is for people to be stretched into doing things that they don't yet know how to do. And so earlier on, you mentioned, you know, people becoming, you know, would come and get more familiar with the practice, and they do, but they know that every time, every week that they come in to one of our classes, they have no idea what's about to happen because it's different every week. Yeah. So we have thousands of different activities, and we may get you almost getting one before we drop it out and bring in another one, because the whole point is not to get too comfortable with something. And again, one of the trainings that a lot of improvisers go through is this idea of failing. A lot of the improv training is deliberately set up to create spaces where you fail. And the idea is that you get comfortable with failing and you get back up again. And I had this lovely anecdote from a gentleman that we were working with who was living with dementia, and he described the failing that he experiences in a voice arts class, because we often say if everybody gets this right, it's going to be very boring. So we're looking to a number of you to please not get this right. And he described the experience of, if I throw you a ball and you put your hand up and you catch the ball, then you have this lovely feeling of success. You're like, oh, she threw me the ball and I've caught it and here it is. But if you throw me a ball and I reach out to grab it, but it goes past my hand, and then I have to throw myself on the ground and stretch my arm out in a vague attempt to catch the ball before it lands on the floor, and it just drops past my fingers, I've failed to catch the ball, but look at what I've just done. Look at the stretching and the energy and the effort that I just went through to try and catch the ball. And it's the same principle for the cognitive stimulation activities that we do. It's stretching to the point of going, I'm trying to get this. Oh, nope, I can't. And again, that feeling of stretching the brain to the point of failure can often feel very scary for people, particularly people living with dementia, but for any of us in the real world. But in these classrooms, we're creating a space where it is safe and it is celebrated for you to have an experience of pushing your brain to the point where it goes, ah! We describe it as cognitive chaos, a point where you just get there and your brain, it just fizzes out because it can't. Pushed it. And you've had an enormous amount of fun pushing it. And everyone's at the same time. And when we can't get it, we celebrate and we laugh and it's joyful, but it's doing really important work at the same time.
These testimonies, right? Because I do agree, it's one of these things you really need to see and then feel it, right? Like what's been some of the heartwarming stories you've heard from people who've attended these classes, how it's impacted their lives?
Yeah. We get a lot of those, and it's one of the privileges of doing the work. People coming to us and saying what a difference it is making to their memory function outside of the class, feeling like that they are, that their brain is working in a different way and in a better way than it had been. We get people talking about the ripple effects of the class, the sense of joy and connection lasting well beyond they step out of the classroom, and it filters out throughout the rest of their days. People talk about, lying in bed that night and just replaying all of the wonderful things that happened in the voice arts classes. Yeah, people talk about their sense of confidence, their ability to better trust their brain, to trust, and also their confidence in themselves as storytellers, and that when they have interactions with their grandkids or anyone else, that they feel that they have this creativity and this ability to be performative and to tell a story and to be playful. Yeah, lots of lovely intergenerational people taking this work out and then doing it with their grandkids, which we really love. No, it's beautiful.
That's powerful. And you talk about stories. Is the biggest story the people that attend these training sessions, the story they understand about themselves? They look at themselves in a different way?
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, changing the narrative, changing the self-narrative from people who just sort of thought, I've got nothing useful to say. I can't be spontaneous. I can't make up a story on the spot. I can't. And then learning that they absolutely can, and just having that trust. Yeah, it's lovely.
Your background, Nicola, is impressive. You've been around the world, right? You've conducted trainings around the world. How do people reach out to you, or if they wanted to learn more about this and wanted to conduct the training session and learn how you do what you do, how can they reach out to you?
Yeah, thank you. Email is probably the best. I'm on LinkedIn as well. I have one of those slightly unusual names, Matthew, where you can just put me into Google and generally you'll find a way to contact me quite easily. But my email address at VoiceArts is Nicola, N-I-C-O-L-A, @voice-arts.org.nz.
I'll put all the details in the podcast description.
Yeah. So, yeah, please reach out. Say hi.
Is there anything I may have forgotten to ask, Nicola? Like people usually ask, like, is there anything or any final point you want to make for our audience?
I think you've asked really beautiful questions. I can't think of anything, Matthew. I just, you know, I love this quote, which I'll leave you with. Oh, I want two, actually. I want to leave you with two. We don't stop playing because we get old. We get old because we stop playing. And I love that. And then, and I don't know who said it, so I can't quote it. But the second one is by Brian Sutton Smith, who's one of my heroes, no longer with us, unfortunately, but he was a play theorist born here in New Zealand, but did most of his work in the States. And one of my favorite quotes of his is that the opposite of play is not work, but depression. If we do not play, we get sad. That is the evolutionary purpose of play, according to Brian Sutton Smith. It is to enable us to get through the day-to-day of life, which often is. Life often is difficult. And play has designed specifically for us to go through life with some joy in our heart. So we've got to keep playing.
That's a perfect way to end, Nicola. Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you want more of these type of stories, interviews, and guests, please follow the Dementia Research Project wherever you get your podcasts. Onwards and upwards.